Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled that after years of trying, I have finally convinced my guest to come back on the show after a stellar first at least one or two appearances. And we're going to have a great show. We're going to talk about routine post-op care for cardiac surgery, and he is the perfect person to do it. I have with me Dr. Mike Grant, who is an associate professor of anesthesiology. He's a cardiac anesthesiologist, and he is the director of our cardiac SICU here at Johns Hopkins. So he really is someone who is just an expert on taking care of these patients who have cardiac surgery in the post-op period. We're going to learn a ton from him. Mike, I'm thrilled. Thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Jed. It's great to be back.
All right. Well, let's start with thinking about these patients who are having, you know, all different kinds of cardiac surgery. What are some general milestones that you think about as you're finishing up and moving into the postoperative period?
Yeah. So, you know, I think what I'll do is I'll focus a little bit more on the ICU side of things because, you know, obviously most of these patients in most centers will spend at least some time in the ICU. So a lot of the way that I think about them is how are you hitting the milestones for recovery that would allow you then to leave our ICU? And it's kind of the things that you might think are intuitive, and maybe we don't explicitly say them out loud, but the ones that you always think about are when do you get the breathing tube out? When do you liberate them from their vasopressors, et cetera? When are they no longer kind of fluid seeking after surgery? And then are they able to manage some of their individual activities of daily living? And that last piece doesn't necessitate them staying in the ICU, but it's certainly a recovery element, and it's something we're working towards for those milestones.
Fabulous. All right. So maybe we should start at the beginning with thinking about mechanical ventilation and how we think about getting them off it. Now, I will say that when I finished training, and you too, right, I think basically 100% of patients were staying intubated when they left the operating room. That's no longer the case, but still many of them are. You probably can tell me more about the numbers, at least what we're seeing. But how do we think about those who stay intubated thinking about extubating them?
Yeah. So this is a huge topic. This is probably one of the biggest things we think about in that first kind of 6 to 12 hours. And you're right. Historically, patients have stayed intubated, and they've stayed intubated more or less because cardiac surgery, given some of its unpredictability after surgery, the fact that patients tend to have a higher bleeding rate, the fact that they tend to be hemodynamically a little bit compromised, the fact that we're in their chest. And so there's a likelihood of them having some compromise to their lungs. All of these things have more or less in the past said, we need to have some period of time where I'm monitoring that patient before that breathing tube can reasonably be taken out. You alluded to this. Recently, that has been turned on its head. It is now more and more the case that people are more and more aggressive about removing that breathing tube as early as possible. The quality measure that has been most adopted most recently is through the STS. They have basically said that you are a high quality operation if you are able to get a breathing tube out within 6 hours of arrival to your ICU. So that's kind of the new standard of care. This is in contrast to the old standard of care that used to say, what we care the most about is you need to have less than 24 hours of total mechanical ventilation after cardiac surgery. That's still a standard, by the way. And if you are still working towards that at your program, that is still very reasonable. However, as I alluded to, all of this is moving in a very, very different direction. And then even more recently, what we have found is that there is some percentage of patients that don't stay intubated at all. You treat them like a standard patient undergoing surgery. The breathing tube comes out in the operating room. And this is something our team has started to participate in over the last about 5 years or so. And depending upon the surgery and the surgeon and the patient, we've become even more aggressive on this. So that's kind of the overarching theme of what we think about with mechanical ventilation.
And Mike, what makes the difference between someone who can and can't get extubated in the operating room? I mean, what tells you, yep, this patient, we're going to extubate this one? No.
Yeah, it's a great question. So the short answer is we don't totally know yet. However, there are some hints. We know that patients that are undergoing kind of basic and straightforward isolated CABG, patients that are going on basic and straightforward isolated valves, patients who have intact ejection fractions, right ventricles look okay, patients who have a good signal that they're not bleeding. All of these patients, in theory, you should be asking the question, is there any reason to stay intubated? As opposed to, is there a reason for us to take the breathing tube out, right? So it's just a cultural shift.
Mm-hmm.
There are some really great studies that have been published more recently. There's one from the JTCVS a couple of years ago that kind of put together a little bit of a checkbox approach to thinking about patients and whether or not they're candidates for intraoperative extubation. And then even more recently, we've been starting to see some examples, observational studies that have tried to identify whether or not intraoperative extubation is really a benefit or not. What they've more or less said is that you can't just be a dabbler in the intra or early extubation world. You really have to be aggressive about it and do it a lot. So if this is something that your program wants to do, you got to do it in earnest, and you've got to come up with protocols that allow you to do it safely, and you got to stick with it so that at least some reasonable percentage, and actually the cutoff seems to be about 40%, which sounds really aggressive, but if you're extubating more than about 40% of your patients, the likelihood of you having a side effect with extubation, things like reintubation or pneumonia or some other issue, those are protected against if you're doing it a lot. Okay. And so, you really have to come up with ways, protocols to be able to get these patients extubated quite more frequently. And you can't just simply say one day, listen, we're all of a sudden going to be a patient who, or a team that pulls patients' tubes in the operating room because there are downstream implications to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when you think about the patients who stay intubated and come to the ICU, what things are you doing in the ICU to try to get them extubated as early as possible?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, the first and foremost is that everybody arrives and we put them almost immediately on some kind of lung protective ventilation strategy. Okay. So that they almost always tend to come out. They're on some obligatory ventilation strategy. So we're giving them concerted breaths. 6 to 8 per kilo. This is traditional, low tidal volume ventilation stuff, a little bit of PEEP. We have moved away from doing recruitment maneuvers, and we're thinking a lot more about driving pressure oriented tidal volume management. And so that's still the hallmark of a normal, healthy patient who you anticipate is going to get extubated early. The next thing that we started doing, and actually we have a great study that was published in 2019 on this, is just simply reversing the patient in the operating room. If you can give the patient muscle relaxant reversant in the operating room, the likelihood of them getting extubated within 6 hours goes up exponentially. And it's something that we actually don't tend to think an awful lot about. In fact, there are some programs that never reverse their muscle paralysis after cardiac surgery. But what we found is that if you do that, then the patient's starting to do spontaneous breaths early and they're able to get extubated early. And then the other piece, and this is a big arm of it, is how are you thinking about sedation? And we can talk about this more specifically, but the way you think about sedation in that early 6 hour, 12 hour timeframe is maybe one of the biggest predictors of whether or not a patient will get extubated early.
Yeah, perfect. And I wanted to ask you about that. So let's talk about sedation and analgesia postoperatively from cardiac surgery. What are some things you keep in mind in general and to try to help promote extubation?
Yeah. So the easiest set it and forget it way that we've traditionally sedated patients is right at the end of the surgery, you take them off their inhaled anesthetic and you put on propofol and then you kind of deliver them into the ICU. And in fact, what you also do is you continue by giving them rescue fentanyl or some other opioid to try to keep a patient nice and quiet while you're doing sign up. That has been the traditional approach. I will admit it's probably still a very common approach. What we've taken to and seen culturally, the big shift is we don't do it that way anymore. We are now instead of operationalizing sedation by having people be RAS negative 4 coming to the ICU, what we're really trying to do is how do we awaken them enough that they are comfortable even with a breathing tube in place? We're assessing their pain and not necessarily using opioids to treat it. Again, another arm of how we are changing thinking around postoperative care. And we're optioning away from propofol, which is going to be a little harder for us to get, I think, a lighter sedation profile, and using agents like Presidex or some alternative that allows the patient to be more interactive and they'll meet their goals of extubation earlier.
Yeah, fabulous. So trying to break away from the traditional, and that's the theme here, right? So it's very hard to make change from something that's always been done a certain way. We've always left people intubated. We've always put them right on propofol. We've never reversed the neuromuscular blockade. So making these changes, I'm sure, takes a lot of effort, but it sounds like is doable when you kind of come up with a plan and an algorithm for doing this rather than just say, let's do it.
Yeah, so I think that's right. You know, an individual can only do so much in some of this regard, right? So you might have a very, very zealot anesthesiologist who's willing to kind of get their patient awoken and come out without any sedation and use multimodals and all that kind of stuff. And that's great. And you should be lauded for that. But the real power here is for you to get the team together. You come up with concerted protocols around these things. What are the priorities on how we're going to get a patient moved from our 8 to 10 hour extubation profile to our 2 to 4 hour extubation profile. And there are some key features. Again, we're going to give some of these tools to your listeners in the references that we have attached. There are ways to do this that you can do in an incremental fashion, but bring people along to protocolize these things to get people to these kind of earlier milestones.
Yeah, fabulous. Now, I remember when I was a resident, there was a thing called the cardiac induction, and this was like, 1,000 mics of fentanyl and 20 of Versed or something like that. Yeah. Obviously, that's not really conducive to an early recovery and early extubation. Have we moved away from that? And then how are we trying to use as much opioid sparing as we can?
Yeah. So this is my actual personal favorite area to discuss. I remember vividly when I was studying for my boards, I had a stem that had come up and it was, how am I going to induce this patient with critical AS? And I remember vividly saying that I was going to give a giant stick of fentanyl because an opioid based anesthetic is the most stable anesthetic. It just really isn't true anymore. And so what we've really taken to now is that, we do use a lot of multimodal agents. We're moving away from opioids. What we found with opioids, and you alluded to this, is that more opioids used in the operating room begets more opioids used postoperatively for a variety of different mechanisms. It also, the more you use, the less likely you are to awaken early. And then, the other reality is we found that high dose versus low dose opioids, there's really not a big difference in outcomes within the surgery itself. And so that has allowed us, it's given us permission essentially to start thinking about using more traditional induction agents. I'll tell you, I can't remember the last time that I induced a patient for cardiac surgery and I didn't use good old fashioned propofol. Now there are measures you got to take to be able to do this appropriately. And those are things like appropriate monitoring, which I know we'll get to. So those are still true, but generally speaking, it's not necessary for you to be thinking about large opioid burden to be able to get people through surgery. Those multimodals, again, we can talk about some of the specifics of that, but they include all the traditional multimodals that we think about. Things like, preoperative Tylenol and, good old fashioned ketamine in the operating room. And that Precedex we talked about is their sedative to come to the ICU. That can be one of their complementary medications in the operating room. And so all of these things are at our disposal, and we're seeing more and more of their use in the cardiac surgical setting.
Yeah, I love it. All right. So you mentioned monitoring. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about monitoring, labs, imaging, these kind of things. So let's start with, a favorite, I'll say a fading, at least outside of cardiac surgery, kind of a fading monitor, the pulmonary artery catheter. So How often are you still using that in cardiac surgery? I know outside of cardiac surgery, we hardly ever use them anymore. How often are you using them? How do you decide who needs one and whether they need to keep it, in the operating room and the ICU?
Yeah, so I love this. PA catheters, you either love them or you hate them. That seems to be kind of the new vogue trend. I will say that cardiac surgery has been a continual adopter. It has stood the test of time, so to speak. The way you can think about pulmonary artery catheters in cardiac surgery is that the one thing we know for sure is the low-risk patient undergoing low-risk surgery, commonly defined as people who have an STS, predicted risk of mortality, of less than about 4%. Euroscore, similarly, about less than 4 to 5%. The utility of PA catheters has more or less been shown to be useless. What they do allow you to do is to monitor things continuously. PA pressures, you can do a thermodilution, cardiac index. The problem with these things is that they don't seem to change outcome. And so you may intervene more, you may give more fluid, you may stay on vasopressors for longer because you're trying to achieve some index. However, we aren't seeing that that's translating to better outcomes. Patients aren't living longer, they're not leaving the hospital earlier, and in fact, some cases, they're staying for a longer period of time. Again, these are low-risk patients, low-risk surgery. So the way to kind of answer your question is that I might think about it in somebody who has multivalvular disease, who I'm getting ready to take care of, redo sternotomy to some extent, but maybe not all comers, or some patients who have some component of cardiogenic failure or cardiogenic shock going into the operating room. That latter group seems to be the group where we're seeing signals of genuine benefit to PA catheters. And so that's probably still the group that I would consider using one. With all the caveats that come along with interpreting PA catheters writ large.
And then presumably if they get one in the operating room, they're going to come to the ICU with it and you're not taking it out in the operating room. And then how long do you continue using and monitoring in the ICU?
Yeah, another good question. When I feel that the PEEK catheter has been put in for maybe dubious reasons, again, that low risk, low risk patient, low risk surgery, I'm going to remove it pretty quickly, like within a matter of hours. Like, it'd be very surprising to have it there by the next morning. That's how quickly I would remove it. And again, it's in part because my risk profile starts to become, I'm intervening on somebody that maybe doesn't need intervention. The alternative is the patient that really needs that PA catheter. It tends to be the case that I want to get them through a couple of milestones. The ones that I care the most about are going to be the, are they done with fluid resuscitation? Are they into their diuresis phase? Are we able to see meaningful reduction in at least vasopressors, if not their inotropes? These are all the reasons that I would then start to consider about getting that PA catheter out. And that might be day 2, 3, 4, 5, depending upon the severity of their illness.
Great. All right. What other monitors are you using? I know there's cerebral oxygen monitoring. That was not a thing when I was training, but I know it is now. Yeah. Tell me about that. How often are you using that? What other monitors are you using in cardiac surgery and potentially post-op?
So cerebral oximetry is an interesting one because, you know, one of the big bugaboos around cardiac surgery is this notion that somebody's going to have an injury to their brain, right? So we see after surgery, patients' incidence of post-operative cognitive dysfunction is pretty significant, about 20% of patients. Delirium is very prevalent. And then stroke still happens in about 4%, 2 to 4% of patients after cardiac surgery. So the idea behind cerebral oximetry makes a lot of sense. How do I potentially identify early some injury that's happening to the brain? The problem with it is that it's pretty insensitive. I mean, it's very sensitive. It's pretty nonspecific. So it's very difficult to know if what you're seeing on ears or any of your cerebral oximetry modalities, it's very difficult to know if that actually is an injury. Now, that being said, there are some studies that show that perhaps by utilizing it, you can identify things early. So you might want to modify your hemoglobin transfusion goals. You might want to modify your mean arterial pressure goals. You may want to flow differently when you're on bypass. All of these things are very reasonable interventions. The problem is we don't know if they translate to better outcomes. The short answer to your question about how does that influence the ICU, well, it's not uncommon for patients to come out and perhaps need some longer term management and monitoring, and they can't be awake for it, right? So these might be some patients who had things like ascending aortic aneurysms, and they need to stay down for a day or two. Maybe they have an open chest because they have coagulopathy. That might be a reasonable group of patients for us to think about monitoring their brain at the same time. Again, not perfect. It's not perfect, but it can give you a little bit of an insight.
And what other kinds of monitors are you using that may be unique to cardiac surgery?
Yeah. So one of the ones that I think has become popularized outside of cardiac surgery are fluid monitors, right? So one of the ways that we've kind of tipped the trend away from PA catheters is to start thinking about an alternative approach that might allow us to not have to use invasive monitoring. Fluid monitors are one of those examples. Again, these are not perfect, but there are ways, graded ways for us to use various monitoring modalities. Varying degrees of invasiveness. Some of them very invasive, require a central line. Some of them less invasive, can slave off an arterial line. Some non-invasive. In fact, they have cuffs that only need your fingers. And these can, based on some proprietary algorithms, allow you to think about fluid management a little differently. Some of the studies that have come out in the cardiac surgical space have shown that patients get resuscitated a little better, may ironically get more volume than what we would normally be comfortable giving, and yet those patients may have fewer complications afterwards, particularly patients who have a history of low cardiac index or low cardiac output syndrome. They may benefit from having kind of a graduated monitor available to you. So, you know, again, not perfect. There's a lot of work that needs to go into this area. So I don't want people to think this is a panacea, but maybe some options going forward.
Great. How about routine labs? Are you checking serial lactates in patients? Are you getting ABGs frequently? What are you doing after surgery?
Yeah. So the short answer is yes. Cardiac surgery still uses a lot of laboratories. And so I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with laboratories. To an extent, I think they can be very informative. And to an extent, I think they can be, they can kind of, like we talked about PA catheters, they can lead to interventions that maybe the patient doesn't necessarily need. My best example of this is serial lactates. We have come to just be very affectionate towards serial lactates just in the cardiac surgical community generally. But the belief that it can help you to understand whether or not a patient has you know, some insidious malperfusion. The other one we really like are central venous gases, or if you have a PA catheter, the mixed venous gases. These things can be good as potential trends, perhaps, especially in the very initial postoperative setting. However, they tend to be a little bit of waning benefit in that first 24 to 48 hours. And so, whereas if we're in the initial resuscitation phase, we do see a lot of laboratory use. Some of it is warranted, some of it not so much. It does tend to guide our resuscitation practice. And so to some extent, I think it can be very informative as long as it's correlating with other markers and other findings. Your urine output drops off and you have a low central venous and your lactate's rising. Okay, great. We've got something pretty pathognomonic here. If, however, you see variable trends and you've got reassuring markers on one hand, but an elevated lactate on another, well, that's where we start having a little bit of a difficulty knowing how to interpret those data. And so I think the answer to your question is yes, we are seeing a lot of laboratory use. And no, I don't know if it's all entirely warranted.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, how about following gases, looking at, you know, for example, an anion gap metabolic acidosis? You're also checking lactates. If you have an elevated lactate, you're going to have an elevated anion gap acidosis. Are there other reasons to follow that acidosis other than the lactate, or are those
This is one I really like to talk about. So, you know, one of the things I love to say affectionately after surgery is there's only three reasons to have a gap acidosis after surgery. Lactate, your kidneys are injured, or you've developed ketones. There's only three. That's it. So we actually have a very straightforward job from an acid-base perspective. And so if I'm seeing somebody develop a gap acidosis, but their lactate's normal, what's really great about that is I've only got two other prongs that I have to go investigate. So you can send off some, you know, ketones in their urine or their or plasma ketones, and they can give you a lot of information very early on about how we're going to manage that acid base. So I do like ABGs. I do think ABGs can be very informative, particularly in that early setting for this reason at the very least.
Great. How about chest x-rays? Of course, there was a time not long ago when every ICU patient got a daily chest x-ray. Are we still doing that in cardiac surgery patients? Who needs one? Who doesn't?
Yeah. This is really dogmatic. We still have a common practice for patients to get one initially on arrival after the OR. That may be reasonable, right? So we've placed central lines. Typically, we don't confirm those central lines in the operating room. We intubated somebody. We haven't really confirmed the endotracheal tube placement. So that's very reasonable. But what we've also taken to doing is it's very common for people to get daily chest x-rays for the first couple of days after surgery. I'll tell you, I don't find them terribly informative. One of the things I commonly say about chest x-rays is if it's to confirm a suspicion clinically, it's a wonderful thing. If you think somebody's bleeding and they might be bleeding into their chest, obviously that's a phenomenal use of an x-ray. If you think that you have a malposition tube of any variety, very reasonable. But as a commonplace kind of catch-all for whether or not a patient has pulmonary edema or their oxygen requirement might be because of fluid, I'm not sure it gives you very much. Especially now with the advent of better ultrasound and point of care ultrasound just generally, I don't know that the use of a chest x-ray on a daily basis for spot checking makes much sense at all.
Yeah. Well, I certainly agree with you in the non-cardiac surgery world. The idea of just getting it doesn't make any sense to me. I think you get it if you have a clinical reason to need to verify something. Otherwise, we really have moved away from that.
Well, you remember, Jed, the days where we used to bring up the chest x-ray on everybody and we'd snap them onto the board and we'd all take turns trying to interpret it. Now, I think there's utility in understanding how to read a chest x-ray, but I really don't know that there's a lot of clinical utility just generally for that practice anymore.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk. We've touched a few times about resuscitation fluids. How do you think about resuscitation, or as you've said a couple times, that resuscitation phase in these patients postoperatively?
Yeah. So the first thing I want to make sure it's clear to everybody is that as much as we may not realize it, cardiac surgery requires a lot of fluid, a lot of fluid. Even patients with low EFs, you may go into the operating room with a 10 or 15% EF, and we're still going to give you 3 or 4 liters of fluid. So one of the things I've always found really fascinating about how we think about low EF or RV failure patients is that we tend to be very reticent to give volume. And I get it. In isolation, that's a reasonable goal. But the reality after cardiac surgery is you are so fluid avid that even low EF patients are going to require quite a lot of it. And so I was fascinated when I came into this world at just how much volume we give despite those patients being in those states. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that we tend to talk an awful lot, just like in the regular ICU outside of the cardiac world, we tend to talk a lot about what kind of fluid we give. And you know, I'll just kind of plant my flag here and basically say, I'm a crystalloid first and second and third in perpetuity kind of a guy. And, you know, we can talk about the pros and cons of the alternatives, but I love good old fashioned crystalloid and a balanced salt solution.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you're comparing that to the possibility of albumin, which, of course, is used a lot in the absence of any evidence. And I'm guessing that you, as an evidence-based guy, have decided, listen, there's no evidence for the superiority of albumin, so I'm sticking with crystalloid.
Well, here's even better. What's better is that there's actually a wonderful article that was published about 2 years ago in Cardiac Surgery where they randomized patients to receiving albumin as their sole fluid for the first 24 hours, including the prime they get for their cardiopulmonary bypass. And they randomized those to a patient who gets balanced salt solution. And this will not surprise you, no benefit whatsoever to using albumin. And so for me, that was the last nail in the coffin, so to speak. I am now a fervent believer that crystalloid first, middle, and last is the best way to go.
Yeah. And of course, you save a lot of money. All right. So when you think about titrating your fluid, what are you titrating to? What are your goals? Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right. And we're back with Dr. Grant's answer to that question.
Yeah. So, you know, again, historically, the way that this has gone is somebody comes out and you get some notion from the operating room about what their filling pressures look like. And traditionally, that's a CVP. So somebody will come out, they'll say, listen, their ideal CVP in the operating room after we resuscitated them based on an echo that we had in front of us and, you know, looking at their anterior chest was, we'll say 10 to 12. And what they have traditionally said is we're going to titrate our resuscitation, that initial postoperative phase, to a CVP of 10 to 12. The challenge is fairly obvious to those of us who don't work in this space very commonly. The moment you've extubated somebody and you're not on positive pressure, or you sit them up in bed, or you get them out to chair, which is what we hope we do early, the CVP becomes way less informative. So I tend to not resuscitate based on CVP. And I can guarantee you there are cardiac surgeons who are listening to this who are cursing me right now. But in all sincerity, I'm not sure how informative it is. What is informative is a trend. It always is. If you were to think that somebody's hypovolemic based on a variety of markers, kidney, you know, urine output, hemodynamics, heart rate, et cetera, if you were to give a fluid bolus, what you're really looking for is responsiveness, right? So this is just resuscitation 101 in the cardiac surgical world. That may mean that you're watching CVP, but you're watching the trend of CVP, not the absolute number, right? You want to see that the CVP goes from 2 or 3 to maybe 6 or 7. But what you're wanting to see is their heart rate, blood pressure, urine output responding simultaneous. I mentioned lactate. You know, I don't think lactate's perfect as a surrogate for resuscitation in the acute phase. I think it's reasonable to look at it as a trend over several, you know, 12 to 15 hours. The problem is lactate's a delayed marker, so it's not perfect as an in-time isolated marker. So I don't love using that on a Q1 hour basis. We tend to reserve it to Q6 hour or so. But, you know, resuscitation is, I just got done saying, we have PA catheters have fallen out of favor. Fluid monitors aren't perfect. I just told you that I kind of like the just bedside check after I've given a little bit of volume. That's still kind of our gold standard, which, you know, I don't think we should be too worked up about that.
Yeah, fabulous. Okay. What about acute kidney injury? You know, I think we all learned this is a major potential complication after cardiac surgery. What are we doing to monitor it, to think about it, maybe to try to prevent it?
Yeah. So just to start off, you know, acute kidney injury after cardiac surgery is somewhere between 18 and 45%. So it's pretty impressive. Most of that is stage 1, thank goodness, by KDIGO criteria. So most of it means that patients are going to sustain an injury that they recover from. However, all injury is associated with greater mortality. That's really kind of compelling. You can have a stage 1 injury and yet still have a higher likelihood of death at 1 year. I think that's really fascinating. So it means that any injury is bad. So what do we do about it? Well, traditionally what we've done is we've just monitored creatinine on a daily basis. Okay, so there's some benefit to that, but creatinine's kind of a blunt marker. It's a little bit of a delayed response. One of the things you kind of allude to is that you take an injury in surgery and then you may not see the actual rise in creatinine for day 2 or day 3. And so you may, for about 48 hours, think a patient's looking great, and then all of a sudden their kidneys start to shut down. So how do you manage that? Well, there's a couple ways. The first is that there are now an evolution of sorts in the way that we can look at AKI. There are early biomarkers that are now available, a little expensive, but they can tell you a little bit about kind of kidney stress ahead of time. This is something that we're using a lot in research. It's becoming more commonplace to use in our clinical practice. Some have questioned the utility of these, in part because if most of it's stage one, maybe we don't need to chase most of our AKI. But that being said, there are, I think, really interesting examples of people who have created kidney attack teams. So let's say you have an elevated stress marker, whether it's either creatinine or one of these early biomarkers. They created these task force that come to the bedside. They stop all the nephrotoxins. They make sure you have reasonable hemodynamic goals. You may change your transfusion triggers depending upon what your goals are. And the long story short is you're protocolizing the care to AKI. And that's some really interesting early data. More needs to be done in this space. But, you know, we're seeing a lot of examples of some benefit. Last thing I'll say is that it tends to be that the horse has left the barn by the time they get to the ICU. Not universally. We can still hurt them there if we under-resuscitate or over-utilize vasopressors. But most of those injuries have been associated with what happens in the operating room, right? So on cardiopulmonary bypass or as a result of the procedure. And so that's not a defeatist way of saying, listen, I don't know how to handle this as an ICU doc. It's just, it's acknowledging that a lot of what you're doing is recuperating an injury that has occurred and to be mindful of that as you're thinking about the patient going forward.
Right. All right. Let's talk about ambulation and physical therapy. So important after any surgery and any ICU. What are you thinking about after cardiac surgery in terms of optimizing this?
Yeah, so I'm going to put my enhanced recovery hat on because that's an area that I'm particularly passionate about. One of the things that we always historically did was a patient had a big old procedure, so they're going to stay in bed in perpetuity. And, you know, one day they'll eventually get up, but only when they're really gosh darn ready to do it. That is not how it works anymore. At the very minimum in our hospital, if you had a morning procedure, you're out to a chair that evening. If you had an afternoon or an evening procedure, you're out to the chair in the morning. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. So getting up out of bed just in and of itself has actually been shown to benefit the patient. Not surprisingly, shorter lengths of stay, lower pneumonia rates, all the good stuff. DVT prevention is an inherent byproduct of this. But one of the things that I think I really want to make clear here is that we used to have a very restrictive standard around how patients could coordinate their care for sternal precautions. Somebody's come in, they've gotten a big whack to their chest. There's concern about non-union of their sternum, a very real concern. And most people use wire cerclage. And so, you know, the question is, how do I use my upper extremities if I want to try to participate in PT? And more recently, there's been this adoption of something called a move in the tube phenomenon, where as long as you keep your elbows kind of down at your sides, you can use your upper extremities for virtually anything. Even things like lifting your body, which it's going to sound sacrilegious to most people, but the idea, as long as you kind of keep your elbows down and at your sides, you can participate more readily. And there are great examples from a variety of different physiotherapists that have published on this that show that this particular movement is beneficial to patients. And so the short answer is up immediately, move immediately. We ambulate patients 3 times a day, period, and they can use their arms.
That's great. That's fabulous. And then are patients going home? Are they going to rehab? Does it matter?
Yeah, so this does matter. One of the things that I've loved to see in the literature more recently is that we are seeing a transition away from just looking at hard binary outcomes, things like, did you die? Did you have a stroke? Did you end up having another MI? And we've moved to more patient-reported outcomes. And one of the biggest ones, not surprisingly, that patients care about is, do I get to go home or do I go to a rehab facility? It turns out that about 10 to 25% of people, depending upon what your risk profile looks like at your institution, go to a rehab facility. And there's nothing wrong inherently with rehab, except that it's not the goal, right? And so what we've seen now more is a shift to some of this early ambulation, early movement of upper extremities, early kind of taking advantage of your own ADLs that are the kind of linchpins to you avoiding rehab altogether. And we've transitioned rehab from facilities to being able to do it in-house. So the next big thing that's happened is that insurances have started to really get excited about this. It's a cheap alternative for you to do Zoom-based home rehab and have patients interact with physiotherapists and their teams remotely. And that has been a huge difference.
Oh, I'm sure getting home, I'm sure, makes such a difference to patients. So completely love.
Well, here's another one that we actually didn't touch on, but it just came to my mind. There was a great study that was done that actually looked specifically at what happens if the morning after surgery, you give a patient their glasses, their paper that they like to read, a cup of coffee, and give them a shower. If you do those, let them put on their PJs. If you do these things, then a patient feels, believe it or not, like a normal person sitting in a hotel room, not somebody who's, you know, marginalized and kind of sitting in a bed and feeling sorry for themselves, right? And this is clearly intuitive. We just don't do it. And it's pretty low cost to do everything I just said.
Absolutely. I don't drink coffee, but I have thought this a lot, that if you took people and you don't give them surgery and anesthesia, you just take away their coffee, you know, they're going to feel terrible the next day, right? And yet we do that all the time. So if we could get the people their caffeine, you know, these kind of things, it seems like that would make a big difference.
I think that's right. And, you know, a good night's sleep is another big one. This was something that I thought really needed to be addressed as well. I think we tend to have an over-reliance on sleep aids on the inpatient setting. I personally really disfavor sleep aids. It's very rare that I would allow somebody to start one new in the hospital. Perhaps if you had one as a chronic need at home, then perhaps, you know, that's very reasonable. But what we tend to see is that paradoxically, sleep aids actually exacerbate sleep issues and you increase delirium rates despite all the well-intendedness around them. So, you know, good old-fashioned environmental, reasonableness, where you're shutting the lights off and trying to interrupt them much less to the extent it's reasonable clinically. These are profoundly impactful. And to your point, it's just going to make people feel normal the next day.
Right. So I remember that one of the major post-op complications from cardiac surgery is AFib, right? So how do you think about preventing that if possible?
Yeah. So AFib, anywhere from about 15 to 35% of patients will have AFib. And if you get a valve, particularly a mitral valve, it could be even higher, about 40%. There are surgical interventions. In fact, very commonly, you'll see people get a concomitant maze procedure when they're in the operating room. But when they come to you, what can you do as an ICU doc? What we know for sure is that there are two agents that stave off arrhythmia. The ones that we know for sure do that are amiodarone. This was based on something called the Papaver trial, oral amiodarone to a load. We recommend that everybody who undergoes cardiac surgery gets oral amiodarone unless they have a contraindication, whether that be liver dysfunction or they have their heart rate's already too low. And then beta blocker. And beta blocker, by the way, is also part of a quality measure associated with coronary artery disease to begin with. So unless you have a contraindication, it is beneficial to be on a beta blocker after surgery. These two agents are clearly beneficial. But you should also remember that electrolyte management is a key to this. Coming off vasopressors early is a key to this. You know, avoidance of inotropes to the extent it's possible is a key to this. And so it used to be that we would very commonly keep people on epinephrine, for example, as an obligatory part of postoperative care. And the shift has been to using less and less inotropy and allowing patients to come off of these earlier. And this has been shown to reduce some of our AFib rate. And so I think all of this in conjunction is a very reasonable approach to reduce that burden.
Right. And when you do amio for these patients, do they do a pre-op load or this is just getting amio post-op?
Yeah, it's great. So if you have the ability to catch them pre-op, the benefit has been shown to load them throughout the course of 5 days leading up to surgery. So that's the coup de grace. That's what you want. If, however, you can only catch them after they've come in from surgery, there is still benefit to you starting that load right at the time of them arriving to your ICU and carrying that on for a oral load in that first 5 days.
Right. All right. Let's talk about blood management. What do you think of in terms of transfusion triggers? There's this kind of ongoing, right? There, some people will say anybody who's ever had any heart issue needs a transfusion trigger of 8. We know that's not what the evidence shows, but what do you think of in terms of transfusion triggers and how do you decide who to transfuse?
Yeah, so I think this is actually one of the areas that cardiac surgery is getting pretty good at, believe it or not. You know, they're not a laggard in this area. There have been multiple different trials, as you alluded to, that have looked at transfusion triggers specific to cardiac surgery, the most famous of which is the most recent TRICS trial that showed that patients who have a transfusion trigger of about 7.5 compared to our kind of more liberal strategy have no difference in outcome, which is really compelling data because it flies in the face of the idea that if you have pre-existing ischemia, then you need a higher transfusion trigger. That has changed the way we talk about transfusion. So the way, you know, I mentioned to you that the idea behind extubation is we're just changing the culture of it. We're not talking about whether we should extubate. We're talking about whether we should not extubate, right? It's the same thing for transfusion. This body of literature has more or less said, okay, it's not a reflex that we're going to transfuse somebody. What we're going to do is we're going to get to a reasonable trigger and then we're going to have a conversation about whether or not it's appropriate. And, you know, all of the various side effects that come from being anemic need to be incorporated into this discussion. But for the most part, what I have seen is that we've at the very least started having a discussion around that trigger of 7 as opposed to that trigger of 8, which doesn't sound like it could be very impactful. But if you have worked in an ICU, pretty much everybody's hemoglobin sits between 7 and 8. And so this conversation gets to come up a lot. And that's great because it means we're doing less transfusing.
And are you using thromboelastography to guide the need for transfusion of both, you know, other non-PAC cells, so of platelets, of FFP, cryo, et cetera?
Yeah. So another area that's been enormously advanced in the last 5 to 10 years is the use of coagulation profiles and panels. You know, as opposed to the standard APTT and PTT and INR, we now have this wonderful assay that gives us, you know, direct understanding of the various constituent parts, right? So to the extent that I might have an interest in giving either some factor, whether that be fibrinogen-based or, you know, platelets of some variety, I now have something that can actually give me a little bit of guidance here. TEG's not perfect. Rotem is another alternative to this. There are other, Quantra is another example. So a variety of different available tests here. The idea is that you don't want to be going blindly into the night to try to figure out whether or not somebody needs a transfusion, particularly of the non-packed red blood cell variety. What I will usually say to people is if the patient is not bleeding, you do not need any of these things. If the patient is bleeding, these things can be very informative because it tells you in an organized fashion how to approach it. When you get to the massive transfusion strategy thing, that we're falling a little outside of what can be very helpful with some of these assays, but at least somewhere in the middle between no transfusion and lots of transfusion, these can be really, really beneficial. And the protocols are just getting smarter and smarter over these years.
Fabulous. All right. Let's talk about lines, tubes, drains. So obviously if not all of these patients are going to have chest tubes. How do you think about managing those? When do they come out?
Yeah, so I've got a couple of really good friends in the cardiac surgical space who have coined the term drainology. And, you know, I'll admit to you, drains were not something that I cared very much about as an anesthesiologist. As an intensivist, maybe a little more so. More recently, I have become frustrated as all get out about it because what happens is patients get these drains. They're placed what feels slightly indiscriminately. I know that's being disparaging, but slightly indiscriminately. And then we pull them willy-nilly. I don't have any rhyme or reason why. Is it because there's a volume thing? Is it because it's serosanguinous and now it's serous? I mean, is it just because it's day 3? The long story short is it's a little bit less about why you're doing it and more about how do you protocolize it in a way that's patient-centric and conscious, right? So in this particular case, what we have started to advocate for the drainology space is the earlier the better. And oftentimes, it's kind of irrespective of how much volume they're putting out. It turns out their lungs are smarter than the tubes. So, you know, they're going to be wicking away fluid better than you will through those tubes. I know that's hard for us to believe, but that's kind of how it works. Is there going to be a scenario where you pull these early and a patient ends up with an effusion? Probably, but at least those can be more strategically managed. The risk to having these foreign objects in your subcutaneous and, you know, intrathoracic space is probably worse than you getting them pulled a little bit early for the most part. And I think that's very reasonable. I'll end by basically saying, as long as you protocolize this and you can get your entire team to kind of rally around it, then it's beneficial. I can't tell you how frustrating it is to spend most of my day tracking down surgeons and trying to figure out if they want these tubes removed. My poor APPs and the residents in the unit are just, they struggle with this. Why worry about any of it, right? And just get it protocolized, address this stuff, make it easier on your team and make it great for the patients.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is these are often a source of significant pain, right? So if we can get these out, that's a huge help to patients and will help reduce the opiate use that we already
That is about. Such a great point. I thank you for touching on that because that's absolutely true.
Great. Let's talk about central line. So probably every single cardiac surgery patient has a central line. When do they come out?
Yeah. So I'll tell you when I think they should come out, and then I'll tell you about what typically happens. As soon as you don't need a central line, it should come out. And I know that seems really obvious, and most will say, well, I don't know. When is that really true? So there's a couple ways to think about this. So any central line that exists is a risk for a central line-associated bloodstream infection. That's just a simple fact. For the most part, there is no time frame that you can have it in where you have zero risk. So what we tend to do is we'll place these. We tend to assess it on a daily basis, multidisciplinary discussion about whether or not there's utility to continuing it. Clearly, if you have a patient who's on vasoactives, there is at least a suggestion that it's safer to do those through a central access as opposed to peripheral, although we do know that you can change the formulations on these. Again, the risk profiles are part of the discussion. The other reality is that we tend to take a lot of labs. And so we often will draw those labs either from an existing arterial line or through central access or a fresh stick each time. There is a patient-centered component to having a central line because, frankly, if you're going to be drawing labs on a Q4 to 6-hour basis, it may be more patient-centered for you to be thinking about doing that through a central line, understanding the risks of asking of accessing a central line that commonly. So this is a cost-benefit analysis. So my short answer to your question is I'd remove it almost immediately within the first 24 hours. But the long-winded answer is it's not so simple, which is why this ends up being a discussion. I think as long as you're having that discussion every single day, then you're in a good spot.
Great. And so patients might have, let's say, both a cordis and a triple lumen. At the cordis, I would think, at the very least, could come out early if you're not bleeding. Is that
Yeah. True? So the introducer catheters, cordis is one of the examples. The other one that people use a lot of is something called a MAC catheter. These big, large bore catheters that allow you to introduce things into them, whether it be a pacing wire or a PA catheter, I fervently believe these things should just come out right after you're done the resuscitation phase. We tend to, morning after the first day, patient will stand, get to the chair, and then we will yank out their cordis. At our hospital, we're one of the few that I'm aware of that does a double stick. So we'll put a cordis introducer along with another central line, typically a single lumen of some variety. We tend to keep the single lumen for a little while just to make sure that everything looks good before that one comes out.
Right. All right. And then how about the Foley? How early are these coming out?
Yeah. So again, I'm going to tell you what I think we should do, and then I'll tell you what we kind of functionally do. Earlier the better. Okay. So this is functionally speaking, if we could get out the night of surgery, I would do that. Practically speaking, that does not happen. It is a reality that because of the degree of resuscitation that we have, the fact that patients tend to have more bleeding risk, the fact that we have such an AKI risk, we tend to hold on to the Foley for a day or two. The way our protocol is written is we oblige ourselves to talk about taking it out on post-op day two. I think we're pretty good at that. I'd say we're in the 80-ish percent range of removing them on day two. And then again, like the central line, there are some advantages to having it that are patient-centered. You know, it's the classic example of somebody is given their first dose of Lasix and then we take their Foley out. I can't think of something terribly less patient-centered than that. That being said, if you're really a strict standard bearer of things like trying to prevent catheter-related urinary tract infections, I totally appreciate why you might be militant about removing a Foley as early as possible. I think the hallmark of this section of our discussion is all foreign objects should get out of the patient as soon as humanly possible. And it tends to be the case that we will hide behind our reservations on things as opposed to recognizing that maybe it's not as necessary as we think it is.
Absolutely. All right, Mike, this has been fabulous. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you want to mention before we move on?
I don't think so. You know, I think the big thing I wanted to be very clear about with this is that we tend to take for granted that every patient we take the cardiac surgery world is going to be this kind of crippled mass of a person that needs, you know, baby mitts to manage them in the first two days after surgery. There are examples of patients that are that way. Generally speaking, though, I think what we're seeing is we're pushing the envelope on earlier and earlier milestone recovery. And I think that can only be good for our patients. And what we've seen is the return on that investment has been fantastic. So I think we're just going to see the envelope be pushed more and more.
Fabulous. All right, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Mike, do you have something you'd recommend the audience check out for fun?
So the Olympics are happening right now. And I am an unabashed Olympic fan. Unabashed. It is on 24/7 in our house during those 2 weeks. I will admit to you, probably like any Olympic fan, I tend to fall off following some of those sports between the Olympics, which is a shame because I come to realize how much I love some of these, you might call them more esoteric sports. And then I get really, really engaged in them again during the Olympics. And I think it's a shame. So I think my recommendation would be not only should we love the Olympics and have pride in the country that we're following, of course, but maybe we should do a little better at kind of promoting some of these sports in the off seasons or quote unquote off seasons, because I think it's not totally fair to them because, gosh, is it fun?
It's totally fun. I couldn't agree with you more, you know, and I'm going to give credit to my wife, who's the one who just kind of leaves it on all day. And every once in a while, I'll, you know, when I'm home, I'll go by the TV and I'll get sucked in. And I ended up watching the steeplechase the other day. I didn't even know what that was. Right. And then, you know, table tennis and all these things I would never, ever watch. But it's, and when you're watching it on this high of a level, it's just fun.
I completely agree. And what, I mean, there, it's also pretty rare that you can, just because of a point of pride, just love something. You know, you're from the United States, so you love the United States competing, or you're from Ireland or South Sudan or whatever. And you just can just love rooting for that team because that's a part of who you are. I get really excited about that kind of thing. So you know, as a Baltimore fan for the Orioles or the Ravens, I feel the same way about US for the Olympics. So, you know, unabashedly, that's what I'm promoting.
Yeah, absolutely love it. I second that. I'm also going to recommend a fantasy series called The Cradle Books by an author named Will White, W-I-G-H-T. It's I just stumbled upon it and I've really enjoyed it. I'm about halfway through. It's long. There's like 10 or 12 books in the series, but they're short, each one. So honestly, each book is probably about a half to a third the size of a traditional kind of long Brandon Sanderson type book. And so I would say this is, thinking of it as more like maybe four to five, as opposed to 10 to 12 books in the series. I'm on, I think, book five now. So far, so good. I'm really enjoying it. So if you're a fantasy fan, check out The Cradle series by Will White. Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. I'll do it anytime. Looking forward to the next invitation.
Me too. All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrac Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic Acrac crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. William Mao is our production assistant. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original Acrac music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the Acrac Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.